Okay, so I am here with Carol Emschweller, who is, well, the author of quite a lot, and it's also your 90th birthday. So, Carol, happy birthday to you, and how are you doing? Thanks for being here.
Oh, well, thank you for the happy birthday.
Yes, yes. We were just discussing a bear that you apparently keep in your house. There's an interesting story behind this bear that you just found it in the mountains.
Well, yeah, at the ranger station.
Yeah.
They were selling them to make money. And that was the best teddy bear I ever saw, better than any teddy bear I ever had.
How many teddy bears have you had?
I don't know. Not for a long time.
Yeah,
I'm 90. The only teddy bears I ever had. And I suppose my kids probably had teddy bears.
Oh, I see.
I don't know.
But this is absolutely your exclusive teddy bear, this one.
Yeah, I just got it not so long ago.
All right, so I wanted to get into your writing, and there's quite a lot here, but I wanted to start off with something that Harlan Ellison wrote in his introduction to your story, Sex and/or Mr. Morrison in Dangerous Visions. He said, "She is the first writer I ever encountered who said she wrote to please herself, whom I believed." Now, this is interesting to me because I'm curious how much an audience matters for you. I mean, if you are writing to please yourself, how does pleasing yourself translate into pleasing readers?
Oh, boy, that was so long ago.
Yes.
You know, I have to think back, and I'm not sure if I'm writing to please myself anymore.
Aha. So you fooled Harlan there.
I'm sure I probably thought that back in those days.
Yeah.
I think I'm writing to sell to the science fiction magazine.
Really? Okay.
I think so, because I think everything I do, if it turns out to be, and it often does, what looks like just a straight story, I say, oh no, I'm going to have to put something in there so I can sell it right away.
Yeah.
So I always slant something. I always try to find something so I can sell it off to a science fiction magazine.
By slanting it, what do you mean by that? I mean, the science fiction magazine market has obviously had numerous changes in the last few decades, and in fact, a lot of have actually closed their doors. I mean, does this mean that you now have to write more commercially, or is the Carol Emschweller slant some kind of crazy angle really enough to get them psyched up?
Well, I think I am doing what I want to do once I think twice again.
Yeah.
I think I do want to have some kooky thing in there or something weird happening. And usually I start off with a strange idea.
Yes.
But if I happen to, like I'm just saying, if I happen to be writing along and there's no strange idea in there, I literally do throw it in on purpose.
Yeah.
And, you're saying that things are different than they used to be. I think, do you think there's more, that we're more open to the fantasy part as opposed to the science fiction-y part? Because that's what I almost always do, a fantasy story.
Yeah.
Although I sometimes do science fiction.
Well, by saying that they differed, I mean, when you were starting out, it was a much smaller audience than there is today. And now you have numerous MFA students. You have a lot of potential writers who are competing for just a select number of slots. And because publishing has drastically changed in the last 10 years, I mean, it's harder for writers of all stripes to carry on selling short stories. Or you say that you're interested in adding that slant no matter what, and I'm wondering to what degree these commercial realities affect your writing, or do you just not care about it?
No, I do care.
Yeah.
No, and that's exactly it. That's exactly the point of me doing science fiction. First of all, I have a name already.
Yes, of course.
And I have sold a story in a day.
Uh-huh.
I mean, send it in
by email,
and gotten an answer at the end of the day sometimes. Now, that never has ever happened to me with literary magazines.
Yeah, yeah.
And so partly because I have a name already, and it was my husband's name, so I had his name.
You're still riding on his coattails even today?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I am. And so that makes it a lot easier for me to sell in science fiction anywhere else. And so definitely, I think I am being commercial.
Yes.
Definitely commercial.
Huh, interesting. But I mean, on the other hand, I can't really call your stories commercial.
No,
there is the slant we're talking about. There is always some element that is just like, what the hell is this? And that's what makes your work very interesting. Are you essentially writing your commercial value based off of your name value? And also back to this issue of waiting around and getting a response into a day. I know that in other interviews you said, you know, I don't have time to wait around anymore.
That's so right.
So
exactly.
I which is totally understandable. Exactly. And you got to get as much as many stories out as
me.
You can. So
yeah.
So I mean, how do you deal with the delay? Do you just keep pumping out the stories?
Oh dear. Yeah. Well, now see, I haven't written months.
Oh really? It's been 8 months since you last wrote something?
Yeah, because of my eyes.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I haven't, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to write again.
Oh yeah.
So that's a thing. So I have to think back. No, I did write fairly fast, mm-hmm. and all the time.
Yeah.
And that's what my hearing aid is quits tweaking.
No problem.
Oh, okay, good.
It's a nice little sound, actually. This is great for radio.
Right. But no, you're so right in the sense that when I got to be in my 70s, 75 or so, and I would send into a literary magazine, and it was literally at least a year before you'd get an answer every single time. And I thought, I'm too old for this. And so I deliberately made this change to where I was known, back to where I was known.
But I'm curious, when you did this, could you only have one story going on at the time? I mean, if you write another story while you're waiting on to hear back on another
In fact, when I quit writing just now, I have two stories in the works. I have about 4 or 5 pages on two new stories, entirely different from each other, which is what I like to do.
Yeah.
I often worked on a couple at the same time.
Yeah.
And like right now, I have one story that involves a batch of kids and is... I don't even know what the science fiction element's going to be in that, if I ever get to it. And the other one's a very peculiar story, which is the complete opposite, the two stories. And I like to work that way, so I'm always working on more than one story.
Have you tried, I mean, you mentioned this 8-month lag time. Have you tried dictating stories at all? Or
I've tried just about everything. You know, funny thing is, I can write. I've answered interviews by email.
Yes.
I've helped with, I mean, I've written an introduction to one of my stories, if that's the way to put it. I can write.
Yeah.
But not fiction. It's a whole other thing to me. It's moving things around and being able to see about a page worth. And I'm very visual, so I don't think I could write by dictation whatsoever. I know people who can, could. I know people who going blind wouldn't bother at all. And one of them is Kate Wilhelm. Do you know her? Way she writes, it's all in her head.
Yeah.
And with me, it's all visually looking at the page, and I'll have to figure out some way to do that.
I'm curious about this, the visual component of sentences. I mean, when you say you have to work sentences and move things around, I mean, is it down on the word level? I mean, you know, what would a typical, you know, sentence be in terms of moving words around and the like?
I don't know quite how to answer that.
Yeah.
I tried to work on my stories, and what I found myself doing was trying to move one paragraph, one sentence away from another sentence, and this got to be, like, I couldn't see enough. I could only see making everything so big. I could only see a paragraph of, like, I could only say 8 lines, maybe.
Yeah.
And I just could not deal with that.
Yeah.
I couldn't seem to do it. And, I've got lots of advice, I must say, because people are going to, they say they can hook me up to my TV set, right? From my TV set, all that kind of stuff. And I keep saying, slow down, let me find my way.
You have to find your own specific way to deal with this situation. You can't let anybody else get in the way of this.
Yeah, because I've already done some things I wish I hadn't. I was advised to buy these $150 glasses, where one is a huge magnifying glass, and I've got it right there.
Bifocals with a sort of like steampunk component, something like
and
that.
Boy, oh boy, I much prefer this little thing you see right there, magnifying glass there. To those $150 glasses.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have made some mistakes. This is why I want to just slow down and Although I've got lots of help, and I know people will help me do it.
Yeah. In the introduction for this collected short stories, which has been collected all in one book, published just in time for your birthday, you allude to there being five different phases of your writing life.
Yeah.
What was interesting to me was that you mentioned the fourth phase, which was just after your husband had passed away, and you say that you were writing stories, and of course these Western novels, because you wanted to have a family. Your kids had gone away and all that. I was curious why the family on page meant more or needed to be sort of there in addition to the real people in your life.
Well, I mean, they weren't, but my family wasn't there.
Oh, okay.
No, that's the point.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, the kids have all gone off.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any kids anymore anywhere near me. And then I didn't have a husband anymore. And I was by myself.
Yeah.
And what I did was, it was sort of a long story. What I did was the very first thing to get into that cowboy stuff, my daughter had a wonderful idea. She said, why don't you go to this dude ranch that I know of, right? And I said, I don't even like horses anymore.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to go. And I just fought her and fought her. And she said, you got to do something. You got to go someplace you never went before. You do something you never did before. And she pushed me up there. And then in 2 days, I was just back to horses and farm life and cows and everything. They had everything up there, pigs and chickens and everything. And
why the aversion to horses?
What?
Why the aversion to horses?
Oh, before? Well, no, when I was a 12-year-old girl,
oh, I see. Yeah.
I was into horses.
Yes.
When I was 12, if I had a dollar, which I didn't have very often, I would go and ride, which was not very often.
Yeah.
And after that, I just, you know, I grew up.
Horses,
there.
They're a lot in the boonies.
Who cares?
Yeah, exactly.
I didn't care anything about them anymore. But then it only took 2 days to realize that this was really great and that And my daughter was absolutely right.
Yeah.
I was just switched away into another life. And then when I came home, though, I didn't write another line for a year.
Oh, wow.
After Ed had died. And I lay comatose in front. I just told Jim Freund almost the same story. I lay comatose in front of the TV set looking at Westerns, trying to see, watching horses and watching mountains.
Yeah.
Which I learned to love the mountains with Ed.
Yeah.
When we were together, we used to climb around a lot.
Yes.
And then after I got through mourning for a year and not doing anything, then I started writing the Westerns, which made myself a family. And the thing is, I wrote like I never... I can see a lot of people doing this, though. For those two novels, like I never wrote before, I didn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
Those people were more real than my friends.
Wow.
And more real than... and they were my life. And I didn't... For 2 years or 3 years, I don't know how long it took to write those... Both those novels, I thought of nobody else, and I didn't go. I didn't go to any movies. I didn't go to any. My friends would give readings, and I wouldn't go. I didn't go to anything.
They were more real than your real friends. Why do you think that is? Why did they?
I don't know how that happened.
Your imagination was that powerful, I suppose.
And my writing changed completely during that. And I think then I went back to science fiction, and I think my writing got. From that experience, I think it expanded into deeper into people, I think. Although I don't think, you know, I don't think I'm as deep as I was into those people now. I think I sort of squeezed back a little bit to the science fiction kind of thing.
You needed to invent people in order to understand them more effectively, or...?
Let me think. I don't know. Of course, they were my invention. I understood that.
Yeah, it's kind of tilting the balance
of
there.
Of course,
they
don't always do what you want them to do, which did happen.
Course. Which is why I suggest that it almost an invented simulacrum of people might also be more effective, because since they're coming from your subconscious, it's not like you are controlling them completely.
No, you're not. I found that out. I used to say before all this, before those books, I used to say that I didn't know where I was going at all with these things. But I got in the middle of a Leaping Man Hill, I guess it was, and the girl in that wants to get her mother off her back. And I think I know, you know, I think I'm riding along you know, every day a little bit of something. And all of a sudden, she's to get her mother off her back, she says she's going to marry this other person just to get her mother. And then she says, and I say, oh my God, what have I said? And that literally stopped the flow of the writing for at least a week.
Yeah.
So I know that somewhere deep inside, I do know where I'm going.
Yeah.
But I had to, when that character said that, it blew everything inside me.
Yeah.
It blew, so I had no idea where I was going to go after she, and that was a perfect thing for her to say. Of course she would say that.
Yes.
So it was so right, I couldn't take it out.
But a situation like this, where someone says something or something happens, it may stop you in your tracks. It may actually send you down a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
I know that in other interviews you've said that you can't force the process, but on another hand, it seems to me that you're also strangled by the process as well, because it moves at its own pace.
Yeah.
How do you
keep
the productivity going? I mean, or is just not a factor for you. You just have to kind of follow the muse.
Well, in that case, I had to wait.
Yes, exactly.
Until it came back. But with these two, another good reason to have two stories going at
the
same time.
So you got two horses going,
So if you get stuck in one, then you can move over to the other one.
Yeah.
I don't seem to get that stuck lately, anyway, in the short stories that I've been doing. I haven't been doing a novel for quite some time now.
Yeah. Have you ever been terrified or really frightened of your ideas? I mean, they're often extremely, they can be horrific, but there is often a jocular edge to them. And so I'm wondering if this has ever posed a problem in terms of writing a story or anything like that.
I don't think so. I haven't even thought of that.
Huh.
How would that be?
You read a book like Carmen Dog. I mean, and a lot of the torture in there, just, it's both funny and it's also just extremely, for me, just really terrifying at the same time. You know, which also makes me wonder, because I've read Carmen Dog and the Mount, and I know that you've said that Kafka is your favorite writer.
Yeah.
And if there's any answer to Metamorphosis, it's Carmen Dog. And I'm wondering the influence of Kafka in this this extremely phantasmagorical narrative.
They used to say that Kafka used to laugh all the time.
Yes.
I think his stuff was funny. I think my stuff is funny.
Yeah.
And one of the weird things, it's strange, one of my last stories, I had my class in here.
Yeah.
And my students wanted to hear it. And I couldn't read it naturally enough. Maybe I could have not very well on the computer. But so one of my students read it for me, and to me, there was not a single funny line.
Yeah.
And it wasn't read with irony. It wasn't read as if all this sort of nastiness was funny or anything like that. I was thinking, where I go to the, I don't know, maybe I'm talking, you could cut this
out. This program is predicated on rambling. And after 90 years, you can do whatever the hell you want.
Oh, good.
Yeah, exactly.
No, so. I was over at the eye clinic right around the corner not long ago, and I heard my doctor, and I think he's a very funny guy, and he was telling two sort of helper people that were about to come into where I was, and he was out in the hall, and he was saying, "You girls are driving me crazy," and I knew it was a joke.
Yeah.
And they come in huddling over, creepy, like, "Oh my God, what have we done?" And they're looking at each other. But to me, that was funny, and I think maybe that's where the difference kind of lies.
Yeah.
In I think my stuff is, almost no matter what it is, funny in a certain way.
Well, there's that Kafka slogan about a book almost being an axe to let the ocean I'm mangling it, I'm sure. What the hell is it? But is that sort of how things are funny? I mean, you're dealing with words. You're dealing with a story that serves as a prism between you, the author, and the reader. And so there's a lot of, a game of Chinese whispers that goes on with these stories. So maybe whether it's funny or whether it isn't funny isn't as important as, well, this is just a crazy idea, this is emotionally true, this is the only way it can actually move forward.
To me, it's a tone of voice thing, I think. And I've been talking about this a lot, about my birthday.
Yeah.
Because I don't want just anybody reading my a really nasty story,
which I've
got right here. And it's happened before. In fact, Ed made a movie with can't remember the name of those dancers that looked like a batch of bugs.
Yeah.
And I did the voiceover for it. And when we auditioned three actors to do the voiceover, two guys read first. And then the producer told me afterwards, he said, oh no, Ed has gotten his wife to write this stuff and it's going to be awful. What are we going to do about it? You know, how am I going to tell her that we don't want her and all that kind of stuff? And then the third reader came along. And after reading a little bit, he said, I really relate to this material. And it was funny and ironic and sort of mean. And it was a whole different thing.
Yeah.
So people have to read me that way, I feel.
How about formulating the plot? I mean, how much of this do you plan in advance? I know that you pretty much plan as you go along, but if you are pushing ahead with words on a story, I mean, you're going to have to look ahead to some degree. So I'm curious how much you can look ahead, or is it really a matter of just moving sentences around that you described at the very beginning, that actually affects the direction forward on the story?
Well, a lot of that moving comes as I'm working on the story and I see it's going a different direction, then I have to come back and change everything, and then it going another direction, then I come back and change it again. I rework a lot. But the plot, let me see. As I keep saying, I think that I don't plan ahead.
Yeah.
But I know the plot is in my fingers. I realize now, you know, I've been teaching for a long time, and I've been teaching plot.
Yeah.
And I think I'm so used to plot now. I for a while, in those middle stories, if you read that introduction that I wrote, that's not all my stories, by the way, at all.
Yes, I saw volume one. Yeah, and I have also seen that some of the stories are elsewhere. I did notice that.
There's a whole lot.
I mean, there's quite a few in there, but I mean, yes. No,
there's a whole backlog coming out, right? Where was I? Now I want to plot. I like to plot. And then there were times when I liked just a structure of some sort. But now I want to plot. And I think it's just, I know enough not to be nice to my characters, you might say.
Yeah.
And if they come to a fork in the road, I know, take the hard one. Take, you know, take the one that maybe is a surprise or whatever, or hurts you. Mm-hmm. So I don't have to plot ahead. I just know how to do it so well, and I've done it so much, I feel as if I know plot. I hope I do anyway.
How do you know that you're not repeating an idea or a narrative connection? Or do you just, I mean, you just have to go ahead and go with the muse, and if you've done it before, so be it, you know?
I think you do. I think I do repeat things a lot. And I have found out, found that when you don't know, when I don't know what I'm doing, and I know that a plot, you know, a plot starts when somebody starts to move to do something, and frequently they just walk out and go on, go for a walk, I mean, and go on a journey. And I know that that's kind of cheating, you know, but I'm inclined to do that every now and then. Mm-hmm. And I hope to have, usually I hope to have a good reason for them to go off and try to find something, you know, and that's part of the plot. But I think I do that more often than I should.
I wanted to talk about how you twist an emotion. Like in Creature, for example, kindness is almost as wild an emotion as just being utterly feral in the wilderness. What kind of inspiration do you require sometimes, you know, whether it be going into a museum or reading something? In the case of the mounts, you took a psychology, an animal psychology class and the like. Right. I mean, I'm curious, at what point do you diverge from the initial point of inspiration where, you know, you get inspired, it puts you along the track, and then once you're into the story, you kind of have to go with the story. Does the point of inspiration kind of lose itself during the course of writing, or?
Well, to think, I'm thinking about the mount right now.
Yeah.
But I forget what Creature was.
Oh yeah, well, Creature. I know you. Well, you did win an award for it.
I know, but that was the time. The story I didn't forget is the grandma.
Yes.
And that's the one I thought should have gotten the award. And Creature, why are they giving me an award for Creature when I've got Grandma?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I do remember Grandma, and I still like that story. But the mount, I think it goes, once I get started, got started on that idea, the psychology of the prey and the predator.
Yes.
That went all the way through, I hope. Anyway, yeah.
Right. Well, let's, I mean, by and large, if you have an idea that you're seized by, I mean, you don't forget that idea. That idea is constantly hanging in the background as you're pushing forward to the end.
I think it probably does, because first of all, that helps you get on. I mean, if you're stuck in the story, which you always are, I mean, who doesn't get stuck? Then you always have the sort of theme of it, the sort of reason you're telling it in the background to sort of help you get new ideas out of the, you know, out of the same themes. You get the more ideas in the same direction.
I'm curious. I know that you say that everything you read is for pleasure. Do you read younger authors at all, or do you, I mean, what kind of stuff do you read to kind of keep the brain percolating?
I just read everything.
You read everything?
I don't read anything now.
Oh, you don't read,
I got my baby brother, knowing that I was so blind, just sent me my first book. Talking book, and I haven't tried it yet.
Have you tried like the Kindle, because you could actually increase the text? My grandmother has a Kindle, and she's become a huge, and she also has some vision
problems.
I've
seen them, and they say there are even bigger ones.
Yes, right? There are. Yeah.
So I haven't tried the big ones, but the little ones don't do it yet.
Yeah.
Don't do it for me. They're not big enough. What was I answering? I was saying something, but now I forget what it was.
Oh, well, we were talking about reading and
oh, yeah, reading. Yeah. Reading, right. No, I always read FNSF and Asimov and all those things. Although Asimov has got awful little, even back then I couldn't hardly read it.
Yeah.
I read all sorts of stuff all the time, and younger writers too, yeah.
Well, have you tried books on tape? Has that worked for you in terms of, like, you know, someone reading to you?
Or? Well, that's the first one. That's the one I just got that my baby brother gave to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what do you do to sort of keep the love of words alive?
Well, the thing is that I just got this.
Yeah.
So this is the first one I've ever gotten. And the thing is, the funny thing is that I have, and I don't know why this is, I have no desire. The books keep coming. And people sending me books and all that kind of thing, and they keep coming. I have no desire to read unless I can write, for some reason or other.
Yeah.
I don't know why. Maybe it would make me feel bad to see that other people can go on writing and I can't. But I have no desire to read whatsoever right now.
Yeah.
And I think it would probably just make me feel bad that I couldn't do it. And I also think it's part of writing, that's feeding my writing.
Yeah,
and
the two are inseparable, basically.
Yeah, that's it. And I'm sure that's true, that I hear a story on the radio and I think, oh, that would make I could put that in the story I'm working on now. And they said, no, you can't.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that if I was reading, it would inspire me to want to do something of my own, and then I would feel, you know, I would feel worse. But I'm not saying I'm not going to get. I might be getting back to writing some way or other.
Yeah. There's no timetable for you, and essentially, it's pretty much you just do what you do what you want. I mean, what do you do these days in terms of you mentioned teaching and having students over? What else do you do?
I'll tell you something. When you're this blind, everything takes six times as long to do. I mean, the mail comes, and you get a bill, and I take it over to this thing, and then I get my Sharpie out and a piece of paper, and I write down how much the bill is for, and then I go and get a check, and then I take it over to my magnifying glass and try to write the check under the magnifying glass.
Yeah.
And this takes, you know, a half an hour to write a check.
Yes.
And so your whole life is like, it wears you out, and it takes an awful long time.
Yeah.
And I have got people that help me a little bit. I imagine I'll get more, because they can send me some girls that can help me out a bit with all this stuff. But this hasn't all gotten started yet.
Yeah.
So.
Well, Carol, I thank you so much for taking the time. It was a pleasure.
Oh, no, it's a pleasure for me, actually. That was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm here with Sharifa Rhodes-Pitts, who was most recently the author of Harlem is Nowhere. Sharifa, how are you doing?
I'm all right. How are you today?
Doing all right? I wanted to, first of all, start with the notion of Harlem as an area. There are numerous skirmishes throughout history, some of them based off of racist fears about what Harlem's boundaries are. And even when you were in Texas, you describe in this book creating an imaginary map of Manhattan. So given this, and given the fact that, well, one person will call Harlem a ruin, another person will call it an East Berlin whose wall is 110th Street, how can any one person really describe its totality? I mean, can this book or can any book really capture it? Or do you essentially fall into the sort of Alexander Gumby problem of an overflowing collection of clippings?
My attempt was not to give a description of Harlem in the colonial sense when cartographers would go off into the bush and make a map, and that it attempts to be true to life. It was really, it remains an idiosyncratic map of this place that is outlined by my personal experiences and my personal curiosities. And in the midst of living here, and really was living here that called for the book, it wasn't the other way around. I didn't move here to write this book. My own personal obsessions and curiosities collided with those of other people, and some of those encounters are captured in the book. Now, whether it's, I guess I don't trust the project of someone that would claim that they were setting out to describe the totality of any place.
Yes.
So that, just simply as that.
How about this? I'm curious about the two worlds between your peregrinations through the neighborhood, talking with people who live here, versus your dutiful efforts in the library to make sense of the history. I mean, you say that the personal quest encouraged this more scholarly quest, and I'm not sure if it's fair to necessarily call it a dichotomy, but I'm curious how the two worked in relation to each other in terms of this book.
Well, it's a funny way of like running back and forth between two fields in a way, and clearly my first encounters in Harlem, which I describe in the book, were through literature, were through books.
Yes.
And then I guess you could say I run to the field of experience when I actually move here, and then I'm simultaneously collecting things from the field of experience and from the field of the archive. And I guess as I finally sat down to sort through everything that I'd gathered in my imagination and in my experience and in my reading, I was conscious of wanting to make all of those things exist on one plane as best as I could. And I think I tried to do that through the way that certain fictional characters sort of move through the book, or move through that one chapter at least, as characters, sort of plucking them from their environment and putting, sort of colliding them together as figures in one scene from their different respective homes in literature. And then also making those figures live alongside with the people that I knew and who told me their stories, or shared, not even their whole stories, just snippets of stories that come out in casual conversation, not through interviews, which I was really conscious about. So I just think my attempt was always to make the things equal in my treatment of them, and not to privilege one over the other.
Well, for example, you do write about going out of the library and seeing there's a man there who's reading the Quran, and you observe this tableau, but the question of what you memorialize, and this is also in relation to that photograph you mentioned, is something that's interesting and sort of hovers in between these or oscillates between these two points. And I guess the question I have is, I detected when reading this book that there was a little bit of, should I impede upon the person who's practicing this kind of private ceremony, but is nevertheless part of the neighborhood, or should I observe him? I mean, was this a struggle in terms of deciding which characters to pick for the book, who to populate the book to really sort of present your view of Harlem?
Again, I think a lot of that is defined by temperament, and I don't think there was a method to it as much as there was my way of moving through the world, which is often as an observer and completely aware that what I observe and then choose to describe is part of a selection process. And you know, it's really important that the book is in no way like my notebook, my unsifted notebook of 7 years in Harlem. It's,
sure,
you know, very specific images, whether they're flashes in the case of that particular man who, in, for me, sitting outside the library, clearly some sort of dedicated scholar or man of religion, who was also selling incense and shea butter as a street vendor, probably not making that much money, was just an interesting tableau, as you put it, of the pursuit of knowledge happening right outside the door of this other, this sort of shrine to that pursuit. And I was always very interested in how a lot of the figures, especially the ones that I knew, when I tell their stories, it's not just like, and this is a funny story he told me, but it's really often those stories are about an exchange of knowledge, the impossibility of seeking the stories and the truth and history in some ways, the evasiveness of those stories. And so I guess when I do go through my, whether memory or notes, or the histories that I read, I'm also, it's very much with a direction. So there's always a choice. You know, I have a background in film. So I'm very much aware of what it means to edit.
Yeah.
And seek and to edit, you know, sort of capture and then sift. And
you describe the Jimmy moment in relation to James Baldwin, and you use a film metaphor to describe that. I'm wondering if you figured out your own kind of answer to the Jimmy while writing this, your own sort of way of craning back and seeing that is the detail you should find out as the camera cranes back. Does it relate to your concern for empty spaces or your concern for some of these figures or these neighbors who were very conciliatory towards you in terms of making sure that, hey, you should be wearing the appropriate winter garb and all that?
Mm-hmm. I mean, the line about the Jimmy, which was really me thinking about some of his evasions,
yeah,
that when he pulls out, it's sometimes at the expense of specificity and what you lose there. And I think in Baldwin's case, a lot is gained always, but as a writer and as someone who reads him closely, like that was something that struck me. And I guess I will leave it to other people to point out my own evasions,
yeah,
of which there are many.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you write of the many funeral parlors in Harlem, and you also write of certain speculations you made.
Mm-hmm.
And early on, you keep your distance. You seem to think that, well, there are certain denominations that inhabit certain funeral parlors, and then you finally decide to talk to one of them and get the answer. Is there perhaps something that is more, I guess, identifying or key in sticking to speculation sometimes over, say, the hard facts? Is there a certain risk if you go one way or the other?
Yeah, I mean, I think that particular scene or sequence, you know, is very much about evasion.
Yeah.
Deliberately.
Yeah.
And about the, I think I used the phrase or the image of being outside of a gate and not invited in. And so I think, I mean, there are moments when I deploy those stories like in a very deliberate way to illustrate or to think about that pursuit of knowledge or of history, of experience. So that a case where, like, for a long while, I hover in front of places but don't go in, but have a relationship to it, either just from passing every day, it's a part of my landscape, a part of my mental landscape, something, a place that I walk by when I'm going home, or a place that I look out the window when I'm at the library. So it's a part of me, but I have no access to its history. And then I also talk about having this hesitation about it because of entering a house of death without cause.
Yes.
You know, which later in that chapter I have cause to enter one, which for me was partly about finding myself as a mourner, like what it meant to actually find myself as a mourner, not a trespasser in such a place. So, but when I do ask, it's not a very satisfying answer.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I'm always aware of my method being at distance from a typical journalist or oral historian who has their set of questions and has this sense of pursuit. And for this book, at least, it may change with other books or other projects where something more straightforward is needed and it's not as personal a project. But I'm very willing to expose the and attempt a different way of gaining knowledge, which isn't about entering a space with a microphone and a notepad and being, which I think those that apparatus actually changes a power balance in certain situations. And that was one thing I don't talk about that openly, really, but that's part of the background, I guess, of why that was troubling for me. And also, some of my experience in journalism is the sense that people don't always answer the questions that are most important. So in a way, one is always trapped outside of the door. It's just whether or not you admit it or not, or whether you decide to form your narrative around what they gave you.
Yeah.
You know, so I guess I'm just trying to create a space for both for personal experience to lead to a sort of exchange of knowledge that has some integrity, and for me, or whatever my ethics for this work right now, but also I think it's something I will challenge myself in the future to approach differently, to approach different subjects differently.
Yeah.
But it's very much like a product of this particular encounter with this place, living here, really not being not being a visitor, but this is just my life. So.
Is there a situation, though, where a different approach or a set of ethics that you've determined independently might not elicit what you want, that maybe some standard way is the only way to persuade someone to talk or to corral a piece of information discovered at the library and align it with your personal experiences in the neighborhood? Or?
I mean, I find I've been really well served by serendipity.
Yeah.
Always. And certainly in the research of this book and in life. So in a way, I surrender to that as a process.
Yes.
For now. And I think, as I said, I think there are other projects or other lines of inquiry that I can imagine requiring a different tact. And I will, challenge myself. And the moment will challenge me to change tact when it's required. So it's just, I feel like it's about being open to that, and then also just my own experience of learning how to write when writing this book. And that's also something I feel very transparent about, is that my line of the questions that I set out with changed as I went along. My feelings about the place and the project changed as I went along. And that evolution, I think, is also hopefully
gotcha.
Something that readers experience, you know. So.
Do you feel that you alluded to a film background earlier, and I had alluded to the photographs that are in this book. For example, you have the 135th Street Library, the corner outside, and you have the West 133rd Street photo from 1877 showing these empty spaces, the Harlem Document Series,
mm-hmm.
the signs with the National Memorial Africa Bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the visual serves as an advantage towards entering territories that you normally would not, or that it allows you some MO or some framework with which to find a reason to connect,
mm-hmm.
say, talking with somebody, or that some man who's with a Quran, or some neighbor who may want to talk with you, that kind of thing?
No, I think that in each case, I think most of those photographs are part of the story in a way. They're not really illustrations. In the case of the Aaron Siskin Harlem document photographs, that was a book that I found in my high school library, which was this visual introduction to Harlem in the Depression era. Or James Van Der Zee's pictures that I talk about were photos that I spent time with in an archive, because before I started writing this book, I had been asked to work on a photo project of a Van Der Zee book that never came to fruition. But so I guess in a way the photographs are like residue of living as much as the conversations are. I would, maybe in the case of the picture of the African National Memorial Bookstore, that is a picture I went to find, but it was because it was a site I was engaged with. But that would probably be one of the few, one of two maybe cases in that book where most of the other photos were part of if they're narrated, it's because they're part of a story or an action takes place around them. It was a product of some sort of stumbling or encounter with the image. And I think also like the encounter with images sort of mimics or echoes some of what I was talking about before, which is the way the landscape becomes part of your conscious experience of a place, and mimics the way one can read an image mimics the way one can read a landscape in terms of what is available and what isn't available to you when you're reading the surface of a thing.
Yeah.
So I guess maybe there's a correlation there just between like what it's like when I'm looking at an image that I don't have any access to, or I could go and research that site, but often enough I'm trying to read what's information is available visually, and I think maybe that's partly how I function a little bit as just eyes in the world. So whether it's a living
yes.
image or one that's on paper.
Got it. So. Dwight Garner, in his review in the New York Times, criticized you for not really including a lot of hip-hop music.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than allow his perspective to color the perspective of this book, I was actually curious about why that was the case. He said it was the equivalent of writing about Harlem in the 1920s without including jazz, and so I'm wondering why you didn't include so much hip hop in this, or why the visuals and why people really mattered first.
I mean, it's not a criticism that I give much, that I pay much heed to. I think critics often talk about the books they wish they had written or someone else had written, so I invite someone else to write that book, and I think other people have. And sort of as I stated at the beginning, the book is driven a lot by my own obsessions and passions and things I think about, and as much as music is one of them, it wasn't one that I chose to write about. And I think also, you know, mainstream culture really often wants black writers to function as guides and interpreters, and I certainly felt that from that particular criticism, and it's not something I'm really that interested in engaging.
You don't want to be the sort of person who ends up leading the walking tour, the tourist. You would rather eke out your own sort of personal approach to how you live in the world and that sort of thing.
It's just what I do.
Yeah.
It's not even something I think about, you know. So I think about the history of how those demands have been made, or how writers have had to respond to them. And I think, you know, part of what it means to be me now, which is a black woman writer in 2011, is that I'm not required to answer those demands.
You write that you'd like to think that the annual African American Day crowd matches that of the 1919 Harlem Hellfighters Parade, which was, of course, moralized by W.E.B. Du Bois. To what extent do you think that the parade participants are familiar with just the absolute roots of culture? I mean, in the book, you point out that, of course, they're familiar with Marcus Garvey and the like. How would you say that the stretch of culture from, say, 100 years ago is reflective in present events? Or is this more just a sort of desire on your part to sort of see a sort of cyclical parade, that sort of thing?
I think that any writer, any historian, or historically minded writer that is engaged with the past and the present at the same time is going to see those links, whether it's about Harlem or about Chinatown or about any place in the world, really. That's our job. It's our job to see it, even if it's not something that's expressed or that's not conscious, because that's what it means to work with history. That's what it means to have your hands in the dust of bones, you know, is that you see the connections. So I take that more as a requisite of my task, to see that line, or to find myself walking in that line. And I also think, and part of what inspired the writing of this book was that there is a really strong historical sense among people in this neighborhood, whether it's tied to specific events, and often enough it is. There is a strong way in which an engagement with history is important here. And So I guess it's a combination of both of those things, just like me doing my job as a writer that's thinking about the present and the past at the same time, and then also the demands of this place, which is, I think, unusually attuned to the trajectory, to the passage of time, and keeping the past nearby. So.
But are there some scenarios in which a historical framework simply isn't going to really cut the mustard with the way that people live?
I mean, in that particular chapter, it's called We March Because, and it ends with an emblem of, or the slogan, We March Because, which came from the 1917 parade, which went down Fifth Avenue protesting the silent march that was protesting lynching and the terrorism that black people lived under because of white supremacy. And I guess not to spoil the book for others who haven't read it, but it's very clear that the parade also ends with an encounter in which young black people, mostly men, are still living with those similar circumstances, which are modified in terms of who is wielding the power, and it's the terrorism is formalized in the guise of the New York Stop and Frisk laws. So I don't think that's a stretch. Yeah. To say that how people live now is related exactly to the particular image that I choose to link that march to in the past. I think it's quite related, and I think that's where, if it has any power, it's because of it's related. You know, it's not just something I pulled out of my pretty brain. So
yes,
yeah.
I wanted to also bring up Ralph Ellison and the Federal Writers Project. You point to the close textual similarities between his interview with a railroad porter during the Federal Writers Project and, of course, a section in Invisible Man. Similarly, you bring up Zora Neale Hurston's glossary of Harlem slang. Then Harlem Hunches, a list of frequencies, also quite interesting. I'm wondering to what degree some of these formative documents are the real indicators of, say, Harlem's past. I mean, can we ever really fully flesh out the details through words and images, or do we have to use our speculation and our imagination to a large degree, even though we have these marvelous documents at our disposal?
I think we use everything at our disposal, and part of what a writer's job is to sift and sort and imagine, yeah, and propose and challenge and all those things. So if you're saying that, or you're proposing that the true version of Harlem's history is only to be found in the transcripts of WPA interviews. I mean, in a lot of cases, they weren't even, a few of those writers sort of would they were writers.
Yeah.
So they would go out to meet someone, they would come back with a piece.
Yeah.
And what's left is not the interview, which, but is a piece. And I think also, you know, there's a separately, but just to challenge the whole enterprise of oral history, as a formalized encounter between people and a way of gathering history, there's the well-documented cases of the way the WPA slave narratives were very manipulated.
Yeah.
And they are not, in fact, a true story in many ways. It's all we have.
Yeah.
And we have to be able to look at the residue of that enterprise with whatever critical tools we have. In some cases, the physical transcripts or manuscripts survive, and you can see that a writer in this, I mean, these are mostly white writers in the South, would put a formerly enslaved person's words into dialect when they hadn't really spoken in dialect.
Yeah.
Or what's left out. You know, there's many stories of people who are quite happy, pleased being slaves. And, you know, those are automatically questionable. There's one that I remember reading just because I was reading these for a separate project when, in the introduction to one woman's testimony, she's introduced as being a perfect old mammy of the old South.
Yeah.
You know, and so this is not a text that you can read with some sense that it is a faithful document or faithful to anything but the interlocutor's own desires.
Yeah. So. Well, would you say that Harlem is Nowhere is also a painful document for you?
it's a faithful document of my own desires and obsessions, absolutely. Yeah.
The pain never stops, I guess. The pain never stops.
What do you mean?
That in trying to pinpoint any history or any memorialization of our present or the past or where the future is, I guess the idea here is that the pain will never stop. The pain will still be there in some capacity. Even when you, I mean, there's one section even late in the book where you say that I really wish I could write a hopeful account of all this stuff. And I'm wondering if, to what degree that optimism, it was difficult sometimes to brush up against some of these painful realities of people struggling to retain their community while expensive housing is going in and kicking out a lot of, like, you know, low-income folks.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I definitely, in the way that the book is a document of my engagement with this place during a particular amount of time in its history and also in my life, that feeling that I express of being despairing comes at a moment when I had been engaged with the political campaign about 125th Street, about the rezoning of it, and encountering the way that even as I, myself and other members of this, many other members of this community chose to engage the apparatus that was supposed to deliver our desires to the city government, it became very clear that that apparatus was designed just to record and sort of give a rubber stamp to a plan that had already been agreed upon.
Yeah.
Without the benefit of multiple hearings that we all went to and other ways of formal intervention. So that was a despairing experience to encounter that that part of the political process that is not actually designed to be influenced by its citizens.
At the risk of a trite and possibly a contrite question, what is the future of Harlem?
Yeah, it's not a question I really like to answer. It's one I've been asked a lot in these past weeks. And I think I always just come back to a couple of things. One is that it matters that the people who thrived in this place and survived in this place under dire circumstances and sometimes celebratory circumstances, all the whole gamut, that they, if they choose to have a way to live, stay here. And I think it's a value that's escaping us, that sense of continuity. You know, I read often these New York City real estate boards when they're reporting on Harlem, there's often the sense of, like, if they can't afford to stay there, like, why should they be able to stay there? Like, there's just, and this is a question of value. This is a question of values. And I don't know what it would take to rearrange the American sense about these things, because it's happening in Harlem, but that same way of thinking drives the destruction and transformation of other places, urban places and rural places, and that one's connection to a place across time is meaningless or valueless in the face of money and development and overdevelopment and the sort of supposedly benign forces of progress as it's seen by the people that are designing the progress, not by the people who live there necessarily. So it relates to, the situation here relates to places everywhere, absolutely everywhere.
Yeah.
But the particular history of this place and the fact of it's being a small place that had such an influence on people all across the world it's what I keep in mind when I think about why it should be preserved, preserved in terms of actual preservation measures, preserved in terms of more imaginative and expansive low-income housing measures. It's specific and unique, and it's also a model for things that are happening in other places.
But nothing can ever be truly preserved. Is there any middle ground between, say, forces of gentrification and forces of preservation?
I mean, in some cases, the forces of preservation are the forces of gentrification, you know, so that's, like, a clear conundrum. That's not, and I mean, Harlem is a place where preservation isn't much, I mean, there are people that really fight and have been fighting for years for preservation measures, and there are very powerful forces that act against it. And it's not sort of a stance towards nostalgia or preserving things in amber at all. It's about the onward march of things, but the fact is that the people that have been walking are sort of being just like run off the road.
Yeah.
So.
Well, on that morbid note, Sharifa, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting.
Thanks. Is that so morbid?
It's like that sometimes. It's shit ridiculous. One hand in the air if you don't really care. Middle finger in the air if you don't really care. It's like that sometimes, man. Ridiculous. Life can be sometimes ridiculous. I'm so appalled, spalding.